This is Andrew Cate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, everything is kinda awesome in the Lego Movie 2, while Dan Gilroy goes off the rails in Velvet Buzzsaw.
My God, what a long 5 years it's been. I just do not have any room in my heart left for movies like The Lego Movie. I was a big, big fan of the first one, but just something inside of me died, and these jokes just don't work for me anymore. And this is a purely, purely subjective thing, and I can't really fault the movie for that per se, because it really just delivers more of that same on-brand, kinetic, colorful action with, you know, these smart-ass jokes and then winking at the camera and celebrity cameos. And honestly, the cameos, they were a little distracting in the first one, but I think in this one, they actually work for the better, especially the Justice League one. I think that's probably the highlight. And for some reason, they used Jason Momoa better in this 15-second little thing than Aquaman did and probably will do over the course of several movies. But in this film, I mean, the story, if it even really matters, is that Chris Pratt's Emmett is, I guess, something immediately after the first film, these new toys from some demon galaxy who's eventually run by the sister, played by Brooklyn Prince from the Florida Project, oddly enough. Basically, they come in, they take over everything, and then it becomes like a Mad Max-style homage. And then they're whisked away to some planet when Tiffany Haddish is playing bad pop music and there's more color. And they're in just an obscene amount of musical numbers in this film. The first one was not a musical in any way. You had the Everything is Awesome playing in the background, this is not a musical. This one is more like a Moana musical. I mean, they're actual musical numbers, and they kind of suck because they're just that, you know, that late aughts pop music a la like the Black Eyed Peas, I guess, is the quickest thing that comes to mind. But it's really, at the very least, I do want to give them credit, though. They really were able to pander to the indie rock nerd in me by mentioning Radiohead and Elliott Smith as kind of like a gag at the All Is Lost moment where everything is not awesome and Charlie Day's Rocket Man guy goes, oh, I finally get Radiohead. So thank you, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, for putting that joke in there for people like me who went to go see this for some reason. But I could probably fly on a little bit about this, so I'm just going to turn it over to you here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue with a sequel like this is just that the original was just so fresh and just blew everyone away that it's really hard to follow up on that. And I did enjoy the sequel. I think it's good, but it's not great like the first one was. You know, I did feel like this one, much like the first one, I felt it like it really brought it home emotionally by the time the third act rolled around. But I thought for some of the first two thirds, it got a bit lost and it didn't really seem to be going anywhere at a certain point. You mentioned the musical numbers. Yeah, I wasn't that big a fan. I thought the first one, I thought Everything Else Awesome was great and I really got stuck in your head. But I can't honestly recall any of the sort of songs, you know, in this one. At least, you know, they're not standing out, except for the end credits song. But I'll get to that in a little bit. But, you know, like I said, I didn't think it is quite as good as the first one, but that's really because it can't be that fresh, innovative thing that the first one was. You know, when people saw that, oh, they're making a Lego movie, the first thought obviously is, well, obviously they want kids to buy, you know, all these Legos, and safe to say, kids bought a lot of Legos, as they have for the past few decades. But the first one was also fresh, original from, you know, Lord and Miller, two guys that I absolutely adore and love their comedic perspective, and they really brought it home there. And I think there's definitely a lot of that here, but there's just so many, it feels like some elements that don't really connect. Obviously, they're clearly doing a send-up, and I read in a great article about this, I believe it was on The Ringer, if I'm not mistaken, about how this is clearly getting very meta about Chris Pratt's career, and they sort of break him off sort of into sort of two essential characters, and you can definitely see where Lord and Miller are sort of going with this, and I think it works to an extent, but it's just not as interesting, I guess, as the first sort of main story in the first film. You know, I feel like, you know, and I also felt like one of the great joys of the first one was that everyone in the ensemble got room to play. And it feels like this time out, you know, there's not as much spread around. It's really a lot of Chris Pratt, Elizabeth Banks, and then, of course, Will Arnett as Lego Batman, who's always really great and enjoyable. And he has really a weird relationship with Tiffany Haddish's character, which is really just odd directions to take these stories in. But like I said, you know, eventually, you know, I was sort of, you know, won over by the charm and bringing the emotional resonance home, but it just didn't have that complete joy that I experienced throughout much of the first half of the original Lego movie.
So I want to go ahead and just kind of spoil the, because and if you've seen the first one, you know where this one's going with the live action sequence where the actual kids and the parents are introduced, even though I just revealed that Brooklyn Prince is in the movie, so you probably would have guessed that by this point. But I have an issue with Maya Rudolph. I never really found her that funny in the first place, and I think, I know you're shaking your head at me, it's just not for me. And in this film, I mean, it's more or less the same, and Will Ferrell kind of is in the background, even though he doesn't show up on camera. It's just, for some reason, these live-action sequences kind of take me out of it. And that's what really kind of held me back from the first one, like me completely loving it. I was a big fan of it, but it was just a little off-putting kind of bringing that element into it. I was just kind of enjoying going through this world. And I know it was, again, just Lord and Miller's really clever way of tying a toy tie-in into something cohesive and showing, oh, hey, kids are playing with toys. It's fine, but it is a little transparent for me. And maybe, again, this is just me being cynical, but it's just off-putting. And, you know, I grew up with a younger brother. I didn't have a sister. And we beat the shit out of each other until our mid-20s. And it was fun. And that's part of the joy. I'm not into this whole, you know, like, sibling camaraderie stuff where, you know, oh, you know, you're mean to each other. And then you just, you know, one of my teeth is still dented back from when he threw a baseball at my face out of spite. So, you know, this some of the message is indeed very much lost on me. This is the Death of Cinema podcast. And that means something different for everyone. And honestly, I'm still trying to figure that out for myself. And the Lego movie really brought me to a dark place for some reason.
Anything could bring Ryan to a dark place as far as I'm concerned, so that's not exactly shocking. But like I said, I enjoyed, and I actually did really enjoy the live action. You know, I definitely could see what you mean. It definitely can be jarring, and it's definitely not going to be something that's for everyone, and I did definitely see what you mean about the transparency of it, but I think that works, and I think the issue, you know, that we're getting at with, you know, this Lego movie series is that I feel like a lot of the adults are going to get a lot of the stuff more than the kids. You know, I feel like a lot of it moves at such a quick pace, and I think Lord Miller are clearly, I think these are guys that are clearly very clever. They did amazing things with 21 Jump Street and 22 Jump Street, really sending up a lot of comedic tropes, and they continue to do that here, but it really does truly feel like, much like, you know, their influence with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, it still feels like they're making animation that's for a bit more of a mature crowd, which is really, I think, interesting. And I feel like the live action is meant to, you know, bring it home to the kids in a certain way. And I'll be honest, I just sort of came up with this on the fly. I think it just sort of, the pieces just sort of fell into place. Legos fell into place, maybe. That's really terrible. But brick by brick. But getting back to sort of my main point, I feel like the live action was sort of bringing it home, making sure it connects to the kids. And I can say from the experience in my theater, all I can say is at the, safe to say, all is lost moment in this film. There was literally, and there was only, it was a massive theater, and there was probably only, I think there was only like two other parents with each of their kids in the theater, and at the point where the very dark low point of the film, which I loved, and that's why I was surprised. I was like, oh, you didn't go with that? But the kids were literally started crying, and they're like, oh my god, it's over. And when they play, you know, met a song and stuff like that, I felt like, you know, I thought that really sort of brought it home and really worked. But I think that's a way of emotionally connecting to the kids in that way. Literally shocking and terrifying them, but then literally like a minute later bringing it back to sort of that, you know, like you said, core sort of sibling relationship, but obviously talking about, you know, main themes of, you know, typical coming of age themes like growing up and sort of where your place is in the world, etc. But like I said, you know, I enjoyed the film. Like I said, I don't think it's nearly even close to the level of the original, but I still think it's a worthy follow-up that, you know, like I said, some of the one-off jokes, there are some that there's like weird jokes like Larry Poppins or something. I actually enjoyed that. I thought that was a weird aside, but there are elements like that, like the Bruce Willis thing. It was like, why is this here? You know what I mean? Like, I don't mind like throwing in random, you know, cameos and stuff like that, but that didn't make any sense to me. Like, I have, like, you know, I thought in the original, I thought they did, I don't know. I know you said something about, you know, cameos being distracting in the original. I didn't find that to be the case sort of at all, perhaps other than like Will Ferrell or something, but obviously that was a bit different with the live action stuff. But you know, I didn't mind it, you know, I enjoyed it, but you know, like I said, I felt like it really brought it home in the third act for me in particular, but it a bit got lost in the shuffle. And like I said, they didn't utilize the complete ensemble like they did last time out. It feels like people like Alison Brie, Nick Offerman, they're just sort of thrown off to the side and get a line here or there whenever they so choose.
You know, I want to end this on a positive note because everything is so dour in my life. And I got to give credit to Elizabeth Banks. I think she's actually she was the strongest part of the first film for me, and she's the strongest one here. You know, nothing against Chris Pratt. I think he has fine comedic timing. But there's just something about the personality that Elizabeth Banks brings to it that is very different than the energy of the rest of the film. And I feel that if there was any emotional grounding in the film, that would probably be it for me. And I do think the film does kind of do it like a little tongue-in-cheek thing addressing some of the criticisms of the first film about how, you know, she did all the work, but Emmett was the one who was hailed as the hero, and even though he was just kind of a nice guy. So that was a nice little kind of rectification, I guess.
Yeah, and just one last thing I wanted to mention. You know, I talked about, you know, how there's an end credit song. I assume Lonely Island is a part of it. It sounded very Lonely Island-esque, but I am admittedly a sucker for meta-humor, and obviously Lord Miller are very much in that camp. And I will say, like I said, you know, a lot of the songs throughout the movie, I didn't really think they were engaging, other than, like, that send-up at the All Is Lost moment of everything is not awesome. But to the end credit song, I don't know, I just, like, I literally watched the end credits through, which is not something I always do, you know, for every single movie, but in this case, you know, I thought they were really engaging, and I thought it was clever just the way they're just sort of literally referencing people's names that are coming up on screen. It's just something you don't see that often, and I thought it was, you know, it just sort of left sort of a pleasant taste in my mouth, and sometimes that's just the power of an end credit song and an underrated element of film in general.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. It's just I don't think too many have been jumping to mine lately, but that's fair enough. That is a good choice. But now let's talk about the I was going to say the elephant in the room, but my God, has this Oscar season just been so miserable? What the hell is wrong with you people? It's just movie after movie has something wrong with it. The Academy is basically bending over backwards for ABC to appease them. They wanted to cut cinematography, editing, live action, and makeup and hairstyle styling from the broadcast, which is just absolutely appalling, and I'm glad that was reversed. It's kind of weird that they're bringing back Queen to perform, even though they didn't want to play in the first place. Adam Lambert's a good vocalist, but it's more Broadway good, not necessarily rock good. And I don't want to send that to sound like a backhanded compliment. I just think he's misplaced is all. But I want to get past all that negativity because it really does sour the whole experience. The Oscars are the one night of the year where I can just be that little kid. This is the very first ceremony that I watched the entire way through. Was the year that American Beauty won. I did have interest in it before, but my parents wouldn't let me stay up late to finish. Fair enough. So the Oscars are, it's my Super Bowl. It's, I like the Super Bowl too. But this is just a very special thing for me. It celebrates film in the way that I geek out about film. Like when I was a little kid and didn't know what cinematography quite was, this kind of helped me put a name to it. It helped me fall in love with surround sound and all this fun stuff. It's just, it's the Oscars, and I want to kind of enjoy it for what it is. So to that end, I have no idea what the hell is going to win Best Picture nowadays. I've been awards watching for a very long time. Obviously there are a bunch of precursor awards from all the guilds and the unions and all the critic circles, and every single one's gone to a completely different film. It seems that most people like Roma, and I know that obviously Alfonso Cuarón is a very well-respected person, so maybe there's a little bit of... I mean, the movie's his masterpiece. It is just an absolutely stunning achievement in filmmaking, but that might not necessarily be enough for everyone because it can be a little... it's a dark movie. It's not really for everyone. And maybe there is some language barrier too, who knows. But I know a lot of people are predicting the populist choice, which seems to be Green Book for some reason. I don't know. The bellwethers just have not really been there for me. It won the Producers Guild, but that doesn't always necessarily equate. It seems like DGA, the Directors Guild, more often than not goes with it. But I'm completely stumped. I really honestly, my gut says Green Book, my heart says Roma, and maybe on the outside, I'm kind of rooting for Black Panther to just upend the whole thing.
Yeah, it is very much a tough call. Honestly, I'm not counting out some other choices. I'm definitely not counting out A Star Is Born, mostly because, look, I'm not saying it's definitely going to be there, but all I'm saying is, based on, you know, the changes, you know, to the voting system, I feel like these changes, I think they do benefit a film like A Star Is Born that could find a lot of spots, you know, on people's list, even if it's not, you know, a number one thing. It feels like that type of movie that would get that up. And although I'm not picking it, per se. In fact, I'm gonna make my prediction right here. I'm picking Roma. I definitely think, and I think your logic is sound with, perhaps a language barrier or doubting. You know, obviously it's very, very much art house, so I certainly would not be shocked if it loses, on Sunday. But, you know, I just feel like Cuarón is this presence that I feel like a lot of people, galvanizes a lot of people, and people, you know, really get behind. So I'm going to go with that as my best picture prediction. And honestly, I guess I would say it is my preference, although, you know, like I talked about, none of my favorite films really of the year got a Best Picture nomination. But I mean, I certainly love Roma, so that's certainly no slight to it. But I'm going with Cuarón and Roma. I just feel like it'd be a good moment. Obviously, there's something else in play here with it also being, you know, Best Foreign Language Film. So that's something that's sort of tricky to sort of work your way around. But screw it, I'm picking it for Best Picture.
So how about this? Roma wins Best Picture, but Cold War wins Best Foreign Film, which I think is entirely possible, because that movie also has a lot of support. It got nominated for directing and cinematography as well, which was, I'd say, a pretty moderate surprise. I know a couple people had predicted it, but it kind of, I don't want to say it caught me off guard. It was just weird when it finally happened, especially, since Bradley Cooper has been such a presence on the circuit this season. But yeah, I'll be doing my ballot again this year. I'll have one printed out for you two on Sunday, and I will report back with how well we did. But digging a little bit deeper into 2019, Andrew is going to start us off on Netflix's,
So now we're going to dive into Velvet Buzzsaw. Wow, where do we even begin with this one? I'm sure many of you have been able to check it out, obviously, as it's, you know, the latest sort of Netflix streaming film over the last couple weeks. Although there's so many, they release so many now, it's hard to even say it's the latest. But obviously, you know, this is sort of one of the earliest, obviously, releases of the year that, you know, definitely would have been on, you know, my most anticipated list if it was coming out later in the year. This is hailing from filmmaker Dan Gilroy. And Jake Gyllenhaal, obviously the creative team behind a great film of Nightcrawler a few years back, which I constantly am always using in my screenwriting classes, because it does a great job of establishing character and stuff. But I'm not going to get into a lecture for this portion of the exam, although it feels like I experienced one a bit while watching Velvet Buzzsaw. But safe to say, it's hard to even really know. I have a hard time even trying to make a gander at like a plot summary, so I don't think I'm going to, but all I'm going to tell you is one thing, and that is art is danger, and that's clearly what this movie is trying to convey. And I feel like, you know, and I was talking to Ryan about this before we started recording, that, you know, when I saw the trailer for this film, and I'm sure many people had the same reaction that I did when I saw the trailer, I was like, this is going to be the campiest, craziest, most batshit movie, you know, of the year. And while it definitely goes some batshit places at certain times, it wasn't exactly the tone I was expecting. And it's also not sort of, I wouldn't say, a self-serious, you know, horror slasher movie. I feel like, you know, it doesn't choose which direction it wants to go, and I think it's to the detriment of the film. I feel like it either would have benefited from going crazy campy, really playing up to it, or, you know, go this, or like really serious, you know, you could go serious horror sort of and really going into the art world. But I think the way the film turned out, it just comes across as sort of like a cliched art is, you know, like I said, art is, you know, it's sort of a cliched version and criticism of the art world and sort of culture, you know, in general, and some of these characters. But, you know, one thing anchoring the film is Jake Gyllenhaal, as always. I think he's really great here, and I also was expecting him to give a completely unhinged performance, much like he did in Nightcrawler, and I definitely wouldn't say it's that at all, but he's still very good. It's a really a nuanced, sensitive performance, and what I love about Jake Gyllenhaal, he's always and constantly surprising as an actor, and that's why I was like, you know, I had one expectation of what he was going to be, and then he was something completely different, and that's what I just completely love about him. He's always constantly surprising, but it's in a good way. It's not just, you know, completely going off the rails every, you know, other role and just sort of going for it. He's really giving his all here, and I think he, you know, helps some of this script, because I think, you know, some of this script, like some of the dialogue, I think is like, I don't know, it's hard to describe. Like I said, I feel like there's so much about this movie, I feel like it's hard for me to put into words exactly how I felt. I didn't completely hate it, I didn't completely love it, I do not think it's a good movie, but I didn't dislike watching it because it was always doing something that I was like, what is this? What is going on here? What is Dan Gilroy trying to convey? But I think, you know, the key to this film is that it really does feel like Dan Gilroy was just left to his own devices. Netflix gave him some of his money and he was just like, you know what, I'm gonna do whatever the hell I want, and guess what, he definitely did that.
Oh boy, this was an exhausting movie. You didn't even bother trying to sum up the plot. I mean, it loosely centers around Jake Gyllenhaal is an art dealer who comes across this collection through plot points that I can't even remember at this point, of this recently deceased man's art collection, and then anyone who looks at the art and is a bad person ends up getting killed. And this is all in the trailer, so you know, they give away the main character's deaths and really pretty overt ways. But I want to talk about some of the things that I liked about it. And I want to start with something that I think may be taken for granted with this film. And obviously, if you have a nicer TV, you got to experience this. I thank you so much, Netflix, for, you know, being a forerunner in 4K and HDR and all that other goofy shit that no one cares about but me. Is Robert Elswit's cinematography. I think the movie, like, he just has such a, I mean, obviously shot my favorite movie of all time in Magnolia. Another heavily nighttimed Los Angeles-based film. He shot Nightcrawler as well, another heavily nighttimed Los Angeles-based film. It's all, like, he just has a knack for shooting this city in a way that I can't even really describe, but he gives it such life, and it's very much on display here, and that's probably the best thing that I can say about it, because the rest of it is pretty confusing. Jake Gyllenhaal, he's wonderful in everything, and he's wonderful in this too. Actually, Okja, he was a little over the top, but again, whatever. He just, you're right, he has a nuanced performance when you think he's going to go campy, and I think that's to the film's benefit. It definitely classes it up a little bit, because I think everyone else is just going, you know, kind of half off the rails. Like, you can see that, like, in between takes, people were told to tone it down. Toni Collette's really the only one who's allowed to kind of go ham at points, and I mean, she, you know, it's Toni Collette, she's another one of those actresses who can do that in her sleep. But yeah, it's hard to know who Dan Gilroy is actually mad at. There's some, like, there are these vague allusions to the art world and, you know, the superficiality and Rene Russo's whatever the hell shit, another art dealer who's, like, conniving and just, I don't know. And David Diggs is a street artist, and David Diggs, one of the best parts in this film too. He just has that 1,000-yard stare, but he's just a guy that has so much presence. I know we always talk about this guy in this podcast, but I'm such a huge fan of the guy. He just has that such charisma that he doesn't even have to say a single word, and he's just so magnetic.
Yeah, he's just been breaking out, obviously, in a big way. Obviously, we raved about Blindspotting in our best of, you know, 2018 list and stuff. You know, I do wish, you know, and like we talked about this before, I was like, yeah, we got his intense stare, and that alone gives him a presence. But I just feel like so much of this cast isn't utilized. Like, why is John Malkovich here? Like, and it's not even John Malkovich, like, he's not even campy John Malkovich. He's just sort of, he's an artist, and I was like, oh, is it going to be a John Malkovich classic before? No, it's just sort of very subtle John Malkovich, and I don't bemoan him for doing something different like that, but I just struggle. I think the problem with the movie is that there feels like there's so many, you know, elements that don't actually serve functions in the overall story, whatever that story may be. I'm still trying to sort of figure that out, but like I said, I didn't hate watching it. I do think, you know, there's something at the core of this concept of, you know, killer art, I think, that is interesting. I just don't think the movie ever completely goes there, or it's ever really understood. Not that I need all the answers, and not that I need to understand, you know, exactly what's happening here. I didn't mind some of the sort of creepy-ish backstory, at least that they were alluding to, but they never, once again, it's one of those sort of feels like half-baked ideas where it's like, oh, is this gonna go somewhere interesting, and then it never quite sort of gets there. There was this one element to the film that I did enjoy, and it was just a really simple thing. It was this running gag of the actress Natalia Dyer from Stranger Things, where she's part of this world, she constantly gets hired and then gets fired, and Penelope bosses keep getting killed, and it was just sort of a simple thing, but it was a through line. It was something like, we know what this character, you know, at least they want to constantly employment, and then it's just constantly running up against that. But the problem is, once again, it feels like an element that doesn't connect to the overall, you know, major story, like I said, whatever that is, whatever Dan Gilroy's point is, it's clear he's angry about something. And, you know, I was mentioning to Ryan before we recorded as well, and there's articles out there, you could probably find it, of Dan Gilroy doing, obviously, when a movie comes out, doing a lot of press, and he alluded to the fact that some of this came from, you know, creative frustration. He was part of this very infamous project that never got made, Superman Lives, the Tim Burton directed film that was meant to star my fave Nick Cage as Superman. I mean, I know people just hear that and they're like, what? Go look up the pictures. I tell you, you won't be you will not be disappointed. But essentially, Dan Gilroy was the writer on that project, and he alluded to the fact that some of the creative frustration he experienced, you know, in that experience, you know, were part of his writing process for this film. You know, and like I said, this really does feel like Dan Gilroy just sort of letting some of his feelings out, giving his voice to some certain characters and not really connecting to an overall story or theme. Like I said, like you can gather from how we've been talking about this film, it's hard to know exactly what it is. I think there's some interesting ideas, and I enjoyed watching some of it, you know, to an extent. I am a slasher guy, but it never really completely goes there. There's sort of a couple weird kills that are like creative in some way, but it doesn't really connect to it. But essentially, I just think the film overall gets a bit muddled, and like I said at the beginning, I feel like it would have greatly benefited from deciding what type of film it was rather than playing this middle ground, which makes it far less interesting.
I think the first 5 minutes of this film are pretty emblematic of the problems with the rest. It basically opens with Jake Gyllenhaal coming to this art gallery, and we're seeing all these different installations, and they're all funny and amusing, but again, they're kind of like, they're meant to be these... I don't even know. I don't know what Dan Gilroy is actually trying to say in this scene. And like I said, that is emblematic of the rest of the film. But here specifically, like, is he making fun of artists? Is he making fun of art? Is he making fun of the art world in general? Is he just, you know, one artist shitting on another's art form? I just didn't know what exactly he was getting at, or if it was just that whole shtick in general from the fine art world in Los Angeles, the modern art world. It doesn't work, even if, like, in particular, the homeless robot or whatever it was, that thing was hilarious and a little bit terrifying. It was absolutely perfect, and I wanted more of that. I wanted more of that tone. And there's this giant sphere where, depending on who puts their hand in there, you have a different experience every time. Like, something different will happen to your arm. It's weird shit, and it, like I said, it's amusing, but it just never goes anywhere, and that's so disappointing. It feels like a complete waste of talent. I shouldn't say complete waste of talent, because I do remember Suburbicon, but it's just something that it was I don't even know if it was a missed opportunity, because there was nothing even ever set up in the first place. This just never goes anywhere, and it bugs me. It really bothers me, because it's so pretty to look at.
Yeah, it just really does feel like it. It felt like the script, and I was in one of those interviews I was reading about Gilroy. I feel like he's been trying to get this made for years, and I was just concerned. I was like, because this feels like the film that would have benefited from maybe a couple more drafts or something. Yeah. Like, because, I don't know, some of the writing just feels like, I feel like Gyllenhaal is the only one who can really deliver this dialogue in this film and make you buy it. And don't get me wrong, Renee Russo, I do like her as an actress, but some of the stuff Dan Gilroy gets is, she's Dan Gilroy's wife, just to be clear. So some of the dialogue her husband gives her, I mean, I can't blame her for giving her all, but I just don't think, you know, sometimes you can't make some of the dialogue sound good no matter how hard you try. But, you know, just overall, you know, I don't think it's a good movie, but, you know, it is one of these films that's an interesting failure that is definitely fun to think about and discuss, even though you might ultimately not get anywhere, much like Velvet Buzzsaw.
Yeah, I'm going to be thinking about this one for a long time and really never just get anywhere. I think we can wrap up this first installment of 2019, at least of 2019-related films, and look ahead to next week. We are going to be reviewing our third Steven Soderbergh movie, making him the most reviewed director on this podcast, with his new latest Netflix offering, High Flying Bird, which, my God, that just looks so good. I can't wait for that. And we're also going to be tackling a sequel to a film that we saw, and I think this might actually be the first time this has happened too. It's a sequel to a movie that we reviewed a couple years ago, and Happy Death Day to you.
Yeah, and I did get to see Happy Death Day to You already, and safe to say it should be make for a very interesting discussion. It's safe to say this is not a sequel that's phoning it in and really going off the rails, and we'll see what came of that next time out. And I'm also really looking forward to the Soderbergh, as it's been getting a lot of really positive critical reception, but that's no shock to the great Steven Soderbergh. But obviously we'll be back with our thoughts on those films, as well as probably some thoughts on the Oscars overall.
And for love of God, please just enjoy them. I know you haven't seen half of the movies. Just enjoy the show, please. See you next week.